Hello everyone, and welcome to the Reading Party podcast with Megan and Lexi. Together, we'll watch, snack, and chat our way through books and films set in the ancient world. We bring our expertise as ancient historians to the table to dissect every detail. We hope you'll grab your favourite beverage and snacks and join us every week on this adventure. Before we start spilling the tea, a brief note on our content. The Reading Party podcast is created for adult audiences. The stories of the ancient world are full of violence and undisguised sexual content, and your hosts aren't afraid to curse up a storm. For those reasons, this podcast is not suitable for under 18s, and certain episodes may not be suitable for those living with trauma. This season, we're focusing on stories set in ancient Egypt, and we'll be bringing in guest hosts that are subject matter experts to help us really dig into the history of what we're reading and watching. With that in mind, let's get going. Lexi and I have our teas and are so ready to start spilling the tea on a ton of ancient stories. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Reading Party podcast. This week, we are talking about Exodus, Gods and Kings, which is a 2014 movie starring Christian Bale and actually a whole host of other fantastic people. I was very surprised to see Sigourney Weaver and John Turturro. I had no idea he was in there, but he is, for me, the iconic actor in the Transformers movie. He's the like FBI type agent dude, and he's hilarious. And he pops up here as Seti the First, not being hilarious. So it was a bit weird seeing him. Anyway, before we get into that, we are joined by the wonderful Dr. Christian Casey. Christian, hello. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Megan. I'm glad to be here. So I guess I'll just say a bit about myself to introduce myself. My name's Christian Casey. I work as a postdoc at FU Berlin on the Zodiac Project, where we're building a glossary of ancient zodiacal terms. We're sort of studying the way that the Zodiac and horoscopes developed and in Mesopotamia in like the 3rd, 4th century BC, and then rapidly spread throughout the ancient world and, you know, still survives to this day. That's the main thing I'm working on now, but I've also written quite a bit about video games, especially Assassin's Creed Origins. So I do a fair bit of looking at popular representations of ancient Egypt critically and celebrating what they get right and criticizing what they get wrong in a way that I hope helps people learn a little bit about the way ancient Egypt really was, because that's the thing that I'm most interested in, is sort of capturing the reality of this interesting place. And also, in theory, maybe leads to good things in the future, where people kind of think they're more careful about how we represent ancient Egyptians. And we have an excellent problematic case study to look at today, so I'm excited.
I was going to say, this is possibly not the best movie for trying to explore the realities of ancient Egypt, given that we're dealing with an event that most likely did not happen as recorded. So this is going to be very exciting.
Megan, since you're so good at them, will you deliver your signature recaps for
us? I will. The exciting thing is that I feel like most people know the story of Exodus, so I don't have to go into massive amounts of detail. But we open with Moses and Ramses being brotherly brothers and doing their comrade in arms thing, and they get a prophecy before they go out to battle against what, the Hittites, the Hyksos, some H name, Orient, thank you, the Hittites. Yeah, weird depiction of the Hittites, but I'm sure we'll get into that at some point. They go out into battle and they have a prophecy saying that like the guy who saves the ruler will one day be the ruler, and of course Moses saves Ramses, and it's all very oh no, this is not allowed to happen. Anyway, they get back. And Seti the First, like, so you're all weird. Why are you two being so weird? This is bizarre. And Moses says, well, I saved your son's life. And he was like, you should be king next. You would be a better king. And I'm like, based on the 15 minutes we've had of the movie, I tend to agree with him. But also, that's not quite how Egyptian succession works, I don't think. So obviously that doesn't happen. And then we find out that Moses is, shock, horror, not Egyptian, which was shocking to no one except the people in the movie, because everyone else knows the story. And he gets exiled and survives an assassination attempt by Ramses' mother, which is, again, not terribly shocking, and wanders off into the desert and marries a wonderful lady and has a baby with her, and then is out rescuing a lamb and gets trapped in a storm and then meets God, who typically is a burning bush. And we do have the burning bush, but we also have a super creepy little kid who is here being Yahweh. And yeah, weird. Very weird.
That kid is just awful.
Oh, he's very vindictive. And I appreciate the vindictive nature. I feel like it really taps into a lot of what you see in the Hebrew Bible. But watching it on screen is very, very strange. And we all know the story. He sends Moses back to Egypt and there's this series of plagues. Except, and I liked this twist, Moses here is a general. So his attempts to persuade the Egyptians to free the Hebrew slaves is a war of attrition. He's like chipping away at Egypt and at the supply lines and starving everyone. And Yahweh's like, this is taking far, far, far too long. We're not doing this. And then just sends all these horrific plagues. And Moses has zero to do with it. It's not like you see in another movie we'll get to later, Prince of Egypt, where he goes in front of Pharaoh and is like, there will be a plague. And then there's a plague. Moses is just really quite horrified about everything that Yahweh inflicts on the Egyptians. Yes, yeah, so the upshot is Ramses loses his son and says to the Hebrew slaves, all right, get the hell out of here. I don't want you here anymore. So they pack up, they go, they flee across the country, and Ramses changes his mind halfway through, musters 4 battalions or whatever of his army and chases after them. And they cross the Red Sea and the Hebrews survive and the Egyptians don't. Yeah. The ending, no one was shocked by. And then Moses goes back and finds his wife and son, who are very, very happy to see him and not at all, you know, displeased that their husband, father just kind of fucked off for however many years. I don't know.
Came back with 400,000 dinner guests.
Yes, yes. I think I'd have been. And Moses says, like near the beginning of the movie, he asks his wife, or his wife says that she would, like she'd rather, I can't remember the way it's phrased, it's something to do with losing her faith versus losing him. And he says, is that still true? And she's like, yes, I would sooner like keep my faith. And he's like, well, that's good because you're going to need it. And then the camera pans to all these like hordes of people essentially on her front doorstep, which somehow she hasn't noticed, despite the fact that she's been standing there talking to him either while these people silently file. Yeah, I don't know. It was a little confusing cinematographically. But we assume she goes with them. We don't really know. And then we end with Moses chipping and then carving the Ten Commandments and having another little argument with God, who's actually, again, weird, creepy 5-year-old. And then the end scene is Moses in a covered wagon, like traversing the desert with his people. And Yahweh kind of walks alongside and then just stops and lets everyone go past him. So, yes, that was a whistle-stop tour of Exodus, Gods and Kings. Thoughts, comments, concerns?
You know, it's weird because like this is one of the few sort of Exodus stories that doesn't start with some sort of expository scene, right? Of like little baby Moses going down the river and being rescued by the basket. So I was like quite unprepared to be like, oh, and they're adults already. All right, cool. No background. I suppose you don't need it, but.
There are a lot of moments like that for me in this movie because it's on Disney Plus, so I just like queued it up and started it. And yeah, there's definitely the, wait, is that Christian Bale? You know, and then that same, like exact same tone of voice, exact same question, different A-list actor's name every single time. Like, is that Sigourney Weaver?
A random queen, what? No, huh? Oh yeah, odd.
Yeah, I think she's T or something. She has like 3 lines in the whole movie. And it's just, It's very odd. You get the impression that like, I think it was directed by Ridley Scott, and you get the impression that he just like picked his favorite people to work with and just convinced them that, which, you know, I don't know. This movie is a weird one because it's not great. It's not awful, honestly. I mean, I really wanted to like it because I love the Prince of Egypt and I love the Exodus story. And I think these are really cool things to depict. Didn't love it. Didn't even really like it, but it was clearly it seemed like almost like a labor of love by the creator. They wanted it to be really good. And so I found myself wondering the whole time, like, you know, you got excellent talent, like a good script, in my opinion. I think there's some cheesy lines, but on the whole, it's pretty good. Really coherent story, even if it kind of wanders around in terms of like location and pacing, like the act structure is a bit wonky. You know, you can kind of feel it. overall, like, it had all the ingredients were there, but then they don't align somehow. And
I wonder if it's like a Alexander Oliver Stone kind of thing. Cause I heard, so it clocked in at 2 hours and like 35 minutes.
Two and a half hours, yeah.
But I like looked up online afterward and I saw that Ridley like released, or there is, or there's talk of something, but there's like a director's cut that's like 4 hours long. And I'm like, well, that might have added in more, but I don't know if that makes it better or worse. But that's why you debate like the Oliver Stone Alexander, because you're like, well, which version is better? Which one did you watch? You know, there's like three or four different versions of that. So I do wonder if like his director's cut would have been better, because yeah, this one really had pacing issues all over the place. I didn't understand why like you would get random historical things in a very like odd, like, because you start so well, because they say, I think they said it starts in like 1300 BCE, and I was like, okay, fine, yeah, sure. And then you have all the pieces in place, because they were like, yes, we're going to battle the Hittites at the Battle of Kadesh, and I'm like, that's a famous battle, that's an Easter egg, I know what that is. And I was like, they even got it right, it's against the Hittites.
But then it wasn't an actual battle, it was them attacking a camp of people.
Yeah, so I was like,
which I found annoying.
I mean, I guess like if you want to situate it in the historical timeline, and Christian, you can jump in here, but like, I'm pretty sure that that battle took place early in the reign of Ramses II, so Seti would have not been alive.
That's what I remember too. And it also wasn't a decisive victory for the Egyptians. It was actually kind of ended in a stalemate and then established peace treaty and boundary lines, because it, you know, kind of, it's where these two large nations met and could go no further, right? So it kind of established a border more than anything. But the movie depicted it as like a decisive Egyptian like surprise attack and victory, which it certainly wasn't.
Christian, how does the movie do in terms of the realities of everyday life? It felt inaccurate, but I don't have the expertise to back that statement up.
Well, it depends on what part you're asking about. So I tried to consider every element of the movie more or less independently. And then, because I think that's, when you're talking about daily life, it's really the tiny details all combined together that kind of create this very powerful sense of viewing another time and place. Like Lexi, you and I have talked quite a bit about Assassin's Creed. And, you know, I always talk about the mangoes, and you love to make fun of me for how much I rant about the mangoes being out of place. But it's the realism of the depiction depends on the sort of dovetailing of all of these individual elements. And so some things I thought they did really well, like the furniture was quite good, actually. It looked like actual Egyptian artifacts that we have in museums. I thought that was kind of remarkable. But then for some reason, the clothing was weirdly dark. They're all wearing like dark clothing all the time, which is just, that's the easiest thing to get right. You know, it's like the Egyptians wore linen. White linen. It's like the shirt I'm wearing right now is made of white linen. It's like abundantly available for any filmmaker to put onto their actors and, you know, put into a scene. Why in the world did they give them this sort of dark, I don't know. And then in the architecture, sometimes the things were good. I remember there's sort of like a bird's eye view shot right at the beginning of the movie, and they kind of show Memphis and the Nile Valley, and it sort of looks Egypt-ish, but then the floodplain is weirdly narrow. Like there's not enough place for people to actually live. And there's pyramids just kind of scattered around on both sides of the river. Like they were just haphazardly thrown there instead of, you know, kind of being in a place that makes sense from the perspective of why Egyptians built pyramids, you know, as tombs on the western bank where the towards the land of the dead and all this kind of stuff. And then I remember one scene in the palace where there are these massive stone columns with reliefs and hieroglyphs carved into them. And I mean, for one thing, it's a palace, which wouldn't have massive stone columns. You know, it's not Karnak Temple. It's the king's house where he lives. So it mostly had wooden columns and brick walls and plastered and painted with like scenes of birds flying into riverbanks and these very like lush, green, naturalistic type things. Instead, it's what looks like, I would call it like, the best term I have is probably like Las Vegas, Egypt. It kind of has that like Las Vegas Luxor quality where it's kind of, everything is brown and like faded. And there's like, it's a weirdly darker brown inside the reliefs, like somebody has sort of rubbed it with something dirty, you know? And so it just looks, it kind of has that ruin quality.
Like kind of grungy.
Yeah, grungy ruin. It's like all these sword and sandal movies that keep getting made somehow, where it's like, the ancient Greeks are like walking around in the ruins of the Parthenon. It's like, but it wasn't a ruin then, right? Like, that's pretty intuitive. It was still a new building at the time. That's what you are intentionally depicting. And there's just a ton of stuff like that where they did some things accurately, which proves that they had access to good information of what things looked like in ancient Egypt. And then in other cases, they clearly just discarded that information entirely in order to make a movie that sort of looked the way, I guess, the filmmakers wanted it to look, or it looked the way they thought that a movie-going audience would expect it to look, instead of just making it look realistic. And this is probably my biggest beef with all depictions of the ancient world, or even in fantasy depictions of, you know, fictional places. I know everyone hates me for this. Like, I'm going to make a lot of enemies here. But in Lord of the Rings, when they're going on the river and there's those two statues, Lexi, I'm sure you know what they're called. Can't remember what they're called. It's two enormous stone statues, which are super cool. But then they have an arm out, like in the air. And it's like, but stone can't be cantilevered 30 meters over a river.
Like that.
Yeah. It's like, I think it would be really cool if there's actually like a stone support holding the arm, like you see in actual statues. I think that would, for me, what I imagine the experience is of seeing these kinds of movies without knowing about the place is you're going to miss a lot of things, right? Because you're not going in with as much information. So you're more new information is hitting your eyeballs or hitting your brain. And a lot of things are going to sort of fall by the wayside because it's just too much information at any given time. But you do sort of subconsciously pick up on a sense of realism and depth when it's there. So if you depict the palace of Pharaoh as we know Pharaoh's palaces actually looked, I think it would be less epic and less grand, but I think it would feel much, much realer and deeper and easier to connect to and just richer as a setting. And I see this over and over again. A lot of creators aim for this sort of fictionalized epic quality in ways that actually doesn't serve the story to the viewer. They sort of have a false belief about what the viewer wants to see that influences their decisions in such a way that they actually end up producing a less successful depiction if they would just let go of these things. So in terms of the depiction of everyday life, a lot of things were very good. I thought there's a scene where the Egyptian soldiers are attacking all the Hebrew slaves, and some of the Hebrews are trying to like get inside buildings to get away from them. And they have these wooden doors made up of multiple slats lashed together that are sort of leaning against adobe buildings. And it's like, yes, we have those things. That's what we have door. You can go to the Met. There's a giant wooden door in there, and it looks like the doors in this movie. The houses and things were simple adobe buildings that we know from tons of artifacts and tomb scenes and other kinds of depictions that this is what houses looked like. So they did really well in some cases. The Sinai scenes, when Moses, when he flees to Midian and meets Zipporah, you know, they have their sort of farmstead there. That was amazing. That's what Sinai looks like. That's what the houses look like. That was really, really on point. And for some reason, when they go back to Memphis, they're like, no, if it doesn't look, you know, if we don't rub some thinned out brown paint on it and then wipe it with a damp cloth so that it has that kind of like head shop Egyptian statue look to it, nobody will believe that it's ancient Egypt. Like, no, just have stone columns with painted hieroglyphs. It looks better. And it's, yeah.
But the statue they have, this is obviously something we hear about a lot in Greek antiquity. Would they have been painted with bright colors, or would you have just had like plain stone statues?
I don't think anyone knows 100% on everything, but for the most part, they were painted. I think in every case where we have evidence of surviving pigment, it's clearly they were quite colorful. I don't think that applies to, you know, if you have a gray, wacky statue that's very, very finely carved and it's intentionally this dark grayish green color. I think those were intentionally left in the original stone because the original stone is so beautiful. If you have a limestone statue of a king, it was probably painted in lifelike colors. That's not something that I'm an expert on, so I'm sure people listening to this who really know about that subject will eagerly point out what I just got wrong, but a lot of things were painted. The hieroglyphs inside of temples were painted, and there's a ton of work that's been done and is still sort of actively being done on polychrome hieroglyphs and what we can learn from them, subject I'm really interested in, because it often, like, we'll find remains of pigments on hieroglyphs or even pigments that are still visible to the naked eye. And then those will actually tell you, for instance, like what species of bird is depicted with this very common hieroglyph. And often we don't know. So my favorite example is, I forget the Gardner number, but the Ba bird, which is in Gardner, it's listed as a Jabiru, which is a South American bird. It's been revised to be like a saddle-billed stork. And that's kind of the consensus view. But when you look at polychrome hieroglyphs, it's clearly a marabou stork. It has the wrong coloring for the animal that everyone claims that it is. Right. So the survival of color in Egyptian scenes, it's sort of understudied, but it's actually really valuable. It can provide really valuable information. For me to depict an ancient Egyptian temple and leave out the color is like, no, that's something that we care about. So that's actually, like, even as a language person, which is what I primarily do, that's actually super important to me. That helps me understand, like, why they chose this sign to use in these words. Or, yeah, I mean, it's just really important stuff. And it's also part of the, just the sense of the place. I mean, the difference between a brown stone building and a stone building painted with intricate, colorful figures is night and day. You feel like you're in a different place. Why wouldn't you want viewers to feel like they're in this place, especially given that it hasn't often been depicted that way in Hollywood movies? You know, why would you choose to depict it the way other Hollywood movies have? Why would you put your viewers in this place they've been to 10 times before? You can depict things as we know they actually were and give your viewers an entirely new setting to experience at the same time. Why would you miss that opportunity? I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me.
I mean, they missed a lot of opportunities because I had a problem with, I don't know if it like showed on your guys' screens, but it was so dark. And so I felt like the whole time I was watching, just like scene to scene, my roommate probably got really tired of me like hearing me scream, but I was like, I can't see fucking shit, bro. Like, oh my God, like make it lighter. So I was like, I can't see shit, bro. Like, make it lighter. And then you'd get like the weird, like, okay, well, if it's at night, you get this weird silvery moonlight, which makes everyone look gray. And then I'm like, now they look dead and gray. Now I really can't see. Make it lighter. There's no light to speak of in like the whole movie. I'm like, there's like one scene where it's a bit light, but I don't know about you guys, but I had a really hard time seeing, and it resulted in me not being able to really watch it until like it was clearly evening here, and I had to watch it in the dark, and I'm still struggling. So I was like bumping the brightness of my TV, and I was like, oh my God, I hate this.
What you just said, Lexi, relates to my point about the clothing. Like, why in the world would you not put all of the extras in white linen tunics? You can pick them up at a shop on your way to filming. Why in the world would you design costumes that don't look ancient Egyptian and look super dark? And I think it was a deliberate creative choice to just make the thing super dark. They wanted it to be kind of raw and gritty, but all you got was just, I can't see anything.
It's how you know it's a real serious movie for adults and not another animated kids thing, I guess. It was,
you know, that's the thing I appreciate most about Prince of Egypt. It's like a beautiful sort of technicolor experience with the light. And then you have that beautiful scene when basically it's like his marriage scene and a bunch of other stuff together in Prince of Egypt. But you get like all the dancing and the beautiful light and this gorgeous like red coat, and then this thing, he's wearing dark weird pseudo armor that actually looked Roman to me, and I was like, what is this? They didn't have breastplates like that. I was like, they have far too much covering in a country where it's hot, and you probably really don't want to wear heavy like Roman breastplated armor thing that they had him in black, I might add. I don't know. Like, there's a lot of weird things that didn't track. But also, I mean, I remember there being a huge kerfuffle when they announced the movie over the casting as well. Because they were like, you should cast, like, actually appropriate actors, not, like, a bunch of white people. Because you're going to whitewash, again, Egyptian history. You know, and I was like, yeah, this is a bad. I mean, it was just as bad because we also looked at Gods of Egypt. And I was like, same issue. You have a Danish white dude being Horus and you have a Scottish white dude as Seth.
And an Australian white dude as the main, like, mortal character.
Yeah, I'm like, where are the Egyptian people or the people who look vaguely Middle Eastern? Like, you can find them. You can really find them.
Hathor was it. Like, it was Hathor.
Yeah, it was weird. The casting choices were... I mean, look, I love Sigourney Weaver just as much as the next person. You know, I grew up loving Ellen Ripley. Amazing, like, person to, you know, amazing character to love. But, like, why was she here? I get the star power aspect where you're like, oh, but we need to sell tickets. But I'm like, this is, well, in America at least, we're like a really religious country. And I hate to admit that. But like everyone knows Exodus. So if you make a movie about it, I don't think you need like that much white star power because people are going to be like, oh, yes, we know this. It's in the Bible. Let's go watch this.
There's a bunch of good questions that I'm kind of surprised we didn't start with the casting because there's a couple things to say about it. One, like blatant whitewashing in a way that you really have to wonder why, because like, what does it serve? This, in some cases, there's a lot of talk. I remember when Ghost in the Shell, the live action version, they cast Scarlett Johansson. There's a lot of talk about like, why isn't this person Asian? But it's like, this is a cyberpunk story that happens to be based on an anime. It doesn't necessarily take place in Japan, and Scarlett Johansson is this A-list, you know, beautiful actress that a lot of people go to the movies just to see her. Like you can kind of make a practical argument that people will of course disagree with, but you can argue for a reason to cast her in that movie. Aside from just having A-list actors that you can put on the movie poster, which again, like I question the utility of that in a movie that presumably could have made a lot of money among religious people, which is a big portion of the US movie going audience. I don't think you really need it. And it's just like, even for the star power, I think the movie was really miscast. Even if like, let's say just for the sake of argument that we don't care at all about whitewashing, we're just going to say like who's best to cast in the role of this movie. Let's say we set it in a different setting where the ethnicity or national origin of the actors doesn't matter at all. Christian Bale is still a terrible Moses, you know, like that's just like that person's personality and acting style does not suit this character at all. It just doesn't make any sense. He's Batman. Moses is not Batman. Moses is the guy with the big beard that carries the tablets. You know, like Moses and Batman should not be played by the same actor. I don't know. And like the actor that they chose for Ramses II, I think I looked up his name. It's like Joel Edgerton. He wasn't known to me before then, but I think he's a talented actor. I think I could imagine him in some really cool roles for him, but he looks like a guy who's going to start a fight in a pub.
He really does.
He doesn't look like a hereditary, aloof, aristocratic, inbred monarch. He looks like a sort of salt of the earth type person. Why would you cast that person in this role? You want an effete, aloof, blue-blooded type
person. They cast a tank and we needed a paladin or a bard.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm ruined by Prince of Egypt because I'm just like, I feel like if you actually cast Rafe, Fiennes. Like he could
I was gonna say Ray Fiennes is who I would have chose for
like he could have morphed into it because he seems like he could pull off the sort of floofy like princeling thing.
That's what you want here. You want someone who was born into hereditary political power and is sort of disconnected from ordinary people. You just don't want somebody who looks like the kind of guy you meet for drinks on Friday night. You want some kind of like detached, out of touch weirdo, you know, like evil elf character. And for some reason they picked this kind of like, yeah, a brawler, like you said, it didn't make any sense, didn't match the character.
Oh my god, wait, I could totally see like a Timothée Chalamet like lean into the role as well.
You'd have to shave his head, then he'd be perfect. Yeah,
because I'm like, no, he fits, because he would have been young, because didn't Ramesses take over at some young 22, 5? I don't remember.
I don't either. Something I probably should know, but I don't.
Yeah, I mean, I just know he took over young enough that he was able to reign for like, he had one of the longest reigns.
67 years or something like this. Yeah.
Yeah.
He died at like 99 and he reigned for.
Also, can we just talk about the fact that like, I know the Exodus story and I know that like the impetus of Pharaoh letting Moses and his people go was the last plague, death of the firstborn son. But can we just talk about how I've always found that part super weird, because knowing what I do of Egyptian history and of Ramesses, if he was the Pharaoh at the time, if that's even a thing, was that like you had like 100 children. So like, yes, it's devastating to lose the firstborn son, but also his reaction was always like, oh no, and my dynasty is crushed and I will never recover. So you need to take all your slaves and leave. And I would have been like, but this man had like over 100 sons. So like technically he wouldn't have been screwed at all, but we don't say that.
Also, wasn't Ramses the firstborn son of Seti? Wouldn't he have died?
Although would he not have died only because Seti was already gone? So you had to start with the firstborn son of the current Pharaoh.
I don't know. I mean, it's not very specific on how exactly the rules work. I think this would be, you have to like, if you're role playing this, you would have to ask the DM for clarification here, because it's the rule is quite vague.
No, it really is. But it's so funny because when I watch like Exodus themed movies, I get really triggered because I remember my nephew is a filmmaker. And I remember at one family Passover, he brought his camera and was like, okay, I want to film every member of the family at our gathering separately and just like talk a little bit about what the holiday means to you, things you like or things you have issue with. And it's somewhere on the internet and I'll have to find it so I can link it back in the show notes. But I have this little segment and I remember so it's like 12-year-old me going off on, this is horrible. You're treating the Egyptians horribly. You're just doing this to satisfy your biblical needs. They weren't actually all terrible. Like what? Like you're giving them such a bad rap. I'm sure they weren't actually like this. They were probably horrible in different ways. So I always think of that like 12-year-old rant, just being like, I'm trying to save it for the Egyptians, man. Like I'm sure they had redeeming qualities. So it never ceases to just be like, yep, yep, I remember I went off then. And if I wanted to really go off, I could still go off now about how this is just royally unfair to the Egyptians. Like, I'm like, they had bad stuff. But I'm like, guys, this is like painting them as the most black and white evil that could be.
This is probably a good point to segue into Egyptian like construction practices, because I mentioned at the beginning, like the Exodus can't have happened as it was written. There are just, apart from the us, I think, I can't remember how many are supposed to leave Egypt, but it's like when you consider the population of Egypt at the time, it's ridiculously disproportionate. There cannot possibly have been that many slaves in Egypt because it's over half the population, I think. I don't remember. Christian probably knows. But
That's roughly what I remember as well.
Okay. Yeah. So how, when we think about like Egyptian monumental building and the pyramids and mortuary temples and palaces and all that kind of stuff, was it all built on slave labor? Would there have been this massive population base of slaves for construction projects, or would some of it have been like corvée labor, people actually being employed as builders?
It's a great question. I don't think anyone has a absolute answer to it. The question of how extensive was slavery in ancient Egypt is still kind of an open question. We think that there were slaves. We think that they had slaves that were essentially prisoners of war from neighboring countries, which, you know, would include people from the Levant. There's evidence for slaves from the Levant in Egyptian texts. One of the tricky things is because the Egyptian language was lost to history and redeciphered, you have a tough time deciding on a word like slave or servant, because it's a tiny difference that actually makes a big difference in how you understand this person's position in society. And there's really nothing in the language that we can use to say, because it's not really connected to anything else. I think it's quite likely that there were prisoners of war used as slaves. And then at the same time, probably most royal building projects used corvée labor, which we generally define as not slavery, but if you live in a place where someone comes and takes part of your food by force under threat of violence and then promises to give it back if you do work for them, kind of becomes slavery becomes a distinction without a difference, right? Like, okay, technically you're not a slave because I guess in theory you could get up and walk away, but that's also not really true. You couldn't just leave Egypt if you were an Egyptian. you weren't free to just go somewhere else. There were checkpoints at the border that both kept people out and kept people in. This is a big component of one of David Graeber's books. I think it's, wait, is it David Graeber? Or I'm thinking of the wrong person. Against the Grain. I think it's in Against the Grain. I'm attributing that to David Graeber, and I don't think that's right. I'm going to look it up real quick. I'm probably just misremembering.
James Scott?
James Scott, yes. Okay. Sorry, I conflated those two authors. They write about somewhat similar things. But yeah, this is a big central theme in that book is in early agricultural economies, you weren't really free to just pick up and leave. You would have to escape. And you see this in the story of Sinuwe when he decides to flee because he's afraid there's going to be a revolution when the king is assassinated. He has to sneak out of Egypt, even though, you know, he's hundreds of miles from where he lived. None of the guards at these border posts are going to recognize him by sight and know that he's fleeing the palace because he fears a revolution. He's just not allowed to leave as an Egyptian. You're not free to just go. So then the question of slavery then becomes really interesting because it becomes sort of philosophical. If you're physically kept in a place, part of the food and resources that you need to survive are taken from you by force and then given back to you in wages for work that you're required by the state to do, also under threat of violence. That's a slave by every normal definition of slavery. But just not in name. So yeah, one way or another, Egypt had what I would call slavery, and it also had probably a large foreign workforce. The problem is just that there's no way to make the math work to equal the numbers that you find in the story of Exodus, which for me, you know, it depends on your point of view. For many people, this is a true story, it's a historical fact, and it's part of their beliefs that it must be. I'm not religious, so that's not true for me. I think it is probably based on a kernel of truth with, you know, and they fudge the numbers a bit to make the story, you know, bigger.
I mean, that happens a lot, unfortunately, both in history and now.
Oh, it happens every time I tell a story. There's always more of whatever it was that made the story interesting the next time I tell it than there was the previous time. I think that's
yeah, that's true. I don't know. Like, one thing I also wanted to just draw attention to was when they showed like the plagues and stuff. Like, I'm sure the plagues, it was based on some historical, there probably was some sort of famine or crop failure or like something that made the beast die. But I just remember thinking like, oh, this is so damn dramatic. Like when you have like the Nile full of just nothing but fish, like dead fish, I was like, okay, that's being dramatic. That, and also like, what was it? The flesh eating swarms of...
There was a plague of like boils, like skin disease thing. And then I think the locusts came afterwards, but it seems like they were conflated.
But they were like scarab beetles or something. Because like the locusts clearly came after. So I just remember being like...
There were flies as well.
That's what they were.
The Scottish accented Egyptian official said the flies were coming from... That he just cracked me up every time he was on screen. That was an amazing accent. But he said that the flies came because of the dead fish or something, and then was the skin disease, and then I think the locusts.
It's embarrassing. I should know this. I grew up Jewish. Oops. But yes, out of all the plagues, like nothing on screen looked like the plagues that I remember. But also I had like the little toy plagues that you would bring out at Passover for children. So I'm like, okay, so there's a reason they don't look the same. But I was like, there still don't seem to be like flesh eating or whatever, like the dude being swarmed. I was like, okay, that's what is this? I mean, it was a cool bit of CGI. And I will say that one of the most intriguing parts of the plagues was the depiction of the last plague, right? The death of the firstborn son. I liked how you could sort of infer with the blowing out of the candles, right? That's like snuffing out the breath of life. And I was like, oh, that's like a super Jewish imagery thing. Okay, I got it. I don't know. Like, I guess I don't know if I was expecting that or because they already used like heavy CGI. I don't know. I love the way they do it in Prince of Egypt that you see it's like a white cloud. And I think that that's a really cool graphic when you see it in that. And I don't like, I was like not expecting them to sort of copy that idea. But it was just a really interesting difference that I noticed.
There was an attempt at a sort of realism, right? Throughout the movie, it's not clear whether Moses is actually talking to a god or is just, he got hit with a rock on the head and now he's hallucinating. It's never clear. Inexplicably, Aaron Paul is in this movie, and he is just, he's the guy who's just kind of like hovering in the background watching Christian Bale's Moses talk to nothing when he's supposed to be talking to God. You see him over and over, just kind of peering around like a corner, watching Moses. It's never really clear whether Moses's experience is real or not. And the same thing happened with the plagues, right? There, I think the Scottish accented actor whose role in this movie is the most inexplicable thing about the whole movie.
Very confusing.
And quite funny. Very funny. I was just like, why did they choose this? This makes, it makes no sense. But he was sort of pointing out like so the crocodiles attacked the people and the fish that filled the river with blood. The frogs escaped the blood. Then the frogs didn't have water, so they died. And then when the frogs rotted, the flies came to all the corpses, and then that led to the plague of flies. And there's sort of this like logical cause and effect that's added to all the plagues to imagine if this really happened in real life, how might it have happened? Same thing with the parting of the Red Sea. It wasn't, Moses doesn't put his staff in the water and it goes like out of the way. There's some kind of tsunami, like massive tsunami that causes the land to dry. So at every point, there's kind of this thing like, you know, this thing might have happened according to a very strict scientific idea of how our world works. But I just go back to the choice to depict things in a weird, alternative, like unrealistic way. Like, why do we care about realism in terms of the biblical plagues? We don't care about realism in terms of depicting the world of ancient Egypt. Like, if I were forced to choose, I would every single time say, depict the world and the setting realistically so that we're transported to a real place that existed in time. And then, you know, gods can come down from the sky and smite. But like, I'm fine with that. I'm on board for unrealistic action, but realistic setting. I feel like they picked the worst combination of those things.
Why come up with naturalistic explanations for all of the plague, but still have like 400,000, 2 million, whatever number of Hebrew slaves in Egypt? Like, make it all line up. So either we're all trying to live in the real world and come up with naturalistic explanations, or we accept the fact that this is a fantastical story. It's probably rooted in some kind of folklore mythology thing, and put in magical plagues and unrealistic numbers of people and make it this pseudo fictional landscape.
But I think that's
instead.
My problem with bringing biblical stories to life in general, because I've noticed like this is a bigger complaint and part of a bigger trend, which is like, since I'm not very religious, right, I don't take any of this at all as like, this is history, this is fact. So I'm kind of like, yeah, I think it's just a bigger trend where like, it annoys me to no end when people who do these kinds of movies are like, okay, I'm going to be really realistic about the fantastical elements and then screw everything else. And I'm like, yes, but when you're essentially straddling the line between reality and fantasy, and I'm going to, as a not religious person, take the fantastical elements as literal like fantasy. So do that. Like, I would rather have some bonkers, weird explanation, high fantasy shit come down into the world. But they don't do that.
I mean, it doesn't serve the story that way, which is what makes the choice so strange. Like, an easy comparison is Princess Mononoke, which is clearly based on the Yamato and the Ainu coming into conflict in Japan. And I don't know the history very well, but, you know, more than 1,000 years ago, you have people with superior technology, but then you also have magic and gods. And it actually tells that real life story very effectively with these legendary elements. But the setting is all super authentic. I mean, it just takes place in a real place that still exists that you can go look at. That's obviously a more compelling and effective way to tell a semi-historical, semi-legendary story than the alternative. We know it works. We've seen it happen. We've seen successful stories be told this way. Why in the world would you choose to go the opposite direction? I think it shows a lack of faith in the audience too. It's kind of like if we don't make the buildings look like they do in every other movie about ancient Egypt, the audience
won't
know we're in ancient Egypt.
Yeah, they won't know what we're doing.
Yeah. And it's like, well, I mean, we're all kind of stupid, but myself included in a lot of ways, but we're not that stupid. you can do a different ancient Egypt. And people who are watching the movie called Exodus Gods and Kings will know that you're in Egypt. They'll go with it.
I seem to see the trend that like people dumb shit down for, especially the American audience, but even the British audience. I mean, and yeah, you're right. Like now that I think of it, like one of the things that makes Miyazaki such a brilliant director, just visionary person in general, is like, you can think to any of his movies, actually. They all have some fantastical element. There's like one maybe or two that try to stay pretty close to real history. But even in something like Totoro, it was one of my favorite movies growing up. And it cannot be confused with anything but grounded in like real world. And yet it allows you to sort of think, you know, like that great scene where the kids are like trying to grow the tree and the dad is like, I hear something, but I don't know what's happening. And then you're like, so is that a dream sequence? Is it real? The fact that it's never explained why the parents can't see, like, can they see cat bus? Clearly not. But like he leans into it and it's great and you love it and it's not dumbed down, even though it's like the most kid friendly of all of his movies, other than maybe Kiki. You're like, this is amazing. This is amazing.
Ponyo, yeah. He just really, too.
Yeah. He trusts his audience though. Like he trusts his audience to get where he's going. Or, I mean, it's like the same thing that you tell every grad student after they give the most boring talk you've ever heard in your whole life. The audience doesn't have to come away knowing everything that you knew when you were making the thing. And this is, this is a common mistake that you see in academics, in their writing, and you see it in film. You see it all over the place. There's this fear that like, if I don't get everything that I thought of into this thing, then it's a failure. People will come away not knowing 100% of the things that I wanted them to know. That just takes some letting go. It almost always works out well. Like you can almost always trust people to kind of fill in the gaps or miss something. And who cares? If they love it, they'll watch it again. Like make a movie that people love. They'll watch it again and pick up on the things that they missed. You know, you don't have to insist that it make perfect sense. So yeah, if this movie had been set in a realistic looking ancient Egypt, probably some of the movie going audience would be like, this isn't what ancient Egypt looks like. I've seen 10 other movies set in ancient Egypt. And like one, fuck those people because they should be more open-minded. And two, like everybody else is just going to go with it. You know, like it's fine. Even if they're confused for a minute, they'll get over it. We can handle being confused.
Yeah, so sometimes just let your imagination go. Although I will say, I know that, Megan, you mentioned it earlier, the sequences with God, right? I'm like, look, I'm already predisposed. If you want just some weird-ass voiceover with the burning bush, the way that Prince of Egypt actually does it, and it's fine. We're like, okay, go with it. Like, it's voiceover and it's a bush. Yeah, the inclusion of the boy.
So I actually appreciated him as a character. He's creepy as hell, but I liked him in terms of you get this kind of malevolent vindictiveness that I do think, and I'm probably going to get hate mail for this, I do think comes across in some sections of the Old Testaments, right? God is jealous and vengeful and fuck you, Moses, for not believing. Right. Like this whole thing, it felt like a lot of what he was doing was as much punishment for Moses for not believing that he was in fact a Hebrew and for accepting God as his God, as it was punishment for the Egyptians for how they treated the Hebrew slaves for all those years and for refusing to let them go. I actually really enjoyed that part of how the movie was set up.
I don't dislike having like a physical person there. I guess my question would be, do you think it was right to have it like be this small boy? Would you have preferred like an adult, something completely different?
So I think if you go with an adult, then you either run the risk of old man white beard, which is weird and tropey and just would be too close to comical, I think, to work for what the movie was doing. If it's a guy, like a younger guy, then you've got two young guys talking to each other and there's too much of a power balance, I think. Having a young kid, it puts an implied power balance in there anyway, because you've got a young child talking to a grown man, but then it flips the whole thing on its head, which is already kind of unsettling. And then you have the young kid being like vengeful and mean and angry all the time. And it I think for me, at least, it was the right choice to make, because it gives you this sense of things being unsettled and off and out of kilter without making it fantastical in a movie that is not embracing the fantastical.
True. And it keeps with the sort of really depressing, just like, it's not a happy movie. There's like, usually you'll get like one or two scenes of kind of, okay, let's lighten the mood, it's a bit happier, but I really didn't feel that. Because like, even like his wedding to Tzipora, when you're like, it's supposed to be happy, and then it still manages to be like depressing, because it's like,
it's really serious.
Because you see his face and he's like, I'm hiding my identity, my past. And you're like, okay, so not happy. There's no levity whatsoever in the whole thing. It goes from like doom to doom to angry to sad to like all of the things. You know what it reminded me of? Maybe it triggered me, because it reminds me too much of The Last of Us 2. Like, that game is just hit after hit after hit, to the point where you're like, I'm numb and I don't really want to keep going, but I will, but I don't like it.
You're basically saying it's too dark.
It is. Like, and I know it's a dark story, but like, Prince of Egypt manages to have a dark story, but that fills me like with hope. And I don't know if it's because it's like a musical, which might help, but like, no, even this as a musical would not help at all.
I'm going to go back to The Boy just for a second, because I noticed something really interesting about the way The Boy portrayed God in the story, which is that he wasn't at all a god to the Egyptians. Like, he never interacted with them in any way. He sent plagues, but from a distance. Like, he truly was a god of these people. And then the gods of the Egyptians never appear, which is another thing that kind of annoyed me about them. Like, it's almost like a plot hole. It's like, I mean, probably going to offend some people here, but the god of this story versus Amun or Montu, or, you know, like, doesn't stand a chance. Like, the Egyptian gods are just way cooler and more powerful than the god in this story. I mean, he really is kind of a boy with magic powers. Should I offend even more people? He's like Aang in the first season. It's like, don't you have superpowers? You don't want to, oh no, you're just going to drop your glider again and run away? Okay, good. Great. I'm glad the superhero is the least effective character in storytelling history. He's like that, which is, I guess, something the movie gets right, because these deities really are belonging to a specific group of people and only operating on their behalf and only expect to be worshipped by them. And you really did get that from The Boy. He's kind of only expecting any kind of, I guess, reciprocity or belief, worship, whatever, from the people that he's rescuing. He doesn't care about the Egyptian. He doesn't care whether they recognize him as a deity or do what he says. They're just strangers to him, which I thought was an interesting thing that it got right. Not too many things like that, but yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just trying to be like, come on, there's got to be some redeeming thing about this. It's really hard to find anything that I find redeeming
about the movie in total.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll say that I feel like I remember there was like a relief that showed the Battle of Kadesh and like Ramesses' golden head helmet crown thing kind of looked like the actual relief. So I was like, oh, that looks sort of accurate.
I don't remember this relief, but I do remember the crowns. And that was something I forgot to mention before. What in the world happened with the crowns? We know what Egyptian crowns looked like. Like, why in the world was every character always wearing like the Nefertiti style crown that literally only appears in that bust and a few other Amarna scenes?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why in the world was everybody having the same incorrect crown? I don't know.
And this crown was from like very long ago as well. So I'm sure it went out of style by then. I don't know. There was a lot of just weird stuff. Like, Memphis, fine. Also, though, I'm like, was Memphis, would it still have been used as a major capital? Because I thought by the New Kingdom, everyone would have been down at Thebes.
Oh, man, that's always a tricky question. Yeah, why was it centered at Memphis? I have to admit, I kind of just took for granted that that made sense. I mean, Ramses did build the city of Pir Amesa and presumably worked on Ptah Paratum in the Delta. The original Exodus story says that the Israelite slaves worked on Ramses, Pitom, and In the Septuagint version, it says One or Heliopolis. And then in the, I think in the Masoretic text, that's left out. But so it's all these like delta cities, right? So it has to be set there for the story to work. But yeah, during the 19th dynasty, the capital would have been Thebes, surely. I don't know for sure. I'd have to look it up then. I'm not super confident in that claim, but I think that has to be so.
But like, that was my thing. Cause I was like, I mean, Memphis was like the ancient capital that they would really like, that was popular in the old kingdom. So I'm kind of like, I know Thebes was built, and I know that especially after the Amarna period, like Tut made a point of being like, we're moving the power back to Thebes. And I can't imagine like between the 18th and the 19th dynasties, they'd suddenly be like, we're going back to Memphis of all places. And, or like, at least like, if you want to make the biblical story work, then just say, we're setting the whole thing at Pi Ramses and done.
I think there's probably a healthy amount in this movie of either this looks Egyptian and people will recognize it, or this is an Egyptian thing people will have heard of, rather than thinking about, oh, is this the right like time period, or is this the right?
Unless you're
Memphis is an Egyptian city that people know, so we'll just, you know, set in Memphis.
You can see pyramids from there.
But like, how hard would it be? Because I know so many movies do this when you establish setting. You have like your big opening shot. This one even had, it said like 1300 BC or whatever. And I'm like, how hard would it be to put on that screen or on the very next one, you're introducing the shot of like Egypt to be like Pi Ramses, like across the top. And then you just go, okay, cool. It's in this city. Done. Like, it's weird. Or have your actors be like, yes, and we're at Pi Ramses. Like, you can set the stage so in so many ways. And like, yeah, okay, they probably don't care about the accuracy, particularly of like city, but you know what? Come on, they gotta know. Like, historians are gonna wanna see historical movies, like do us a solid. Like, if you're gonna go to the trouble of making your plagues realistic, you could at least tell me the right city that you're in. I wouldn't think that would be so hard.
I don't think we can ask filmmakers to care about what the Uber nerds are going to complain about. I mean, like, so my friend growing up, his dad was a Navy fighter pilot, retired by the time I knew him. But I watched Top Gun with him one time. And oh my God, it's like unwatchable with him. It's so obnoxious. Like, he had so many comments on what they were, you know, doing wrong or what was unrealistic. And it's like, but, you know, one of the ones that I specifically remember was anytime they're talking in the movie, they take their oxygen masks off so that you can see their lips moving. And he's like, how can you breathe? You have no oxygen right now. And it's like, yeah, but we want to see their faces because it's a movie. You know, it's like, so I don't think filmmakers necessarily need to care about what super experts notice is wrong. The thing that really sticks out for me, and this, you know, all the times that I write about this and think about this, if you read the paper I wrote about, one of the papers about Assassin's Creed, I kind of argue that like these contentions about accuracy actually don't matter in this case. And so I'm on the one hand, I'm saying like, why don't they make things more true to life? And on the other hand, I'm saying like, actually accuracy in this regard doesn't matter at all. And it feels, even to me, it feels sort of capricious or arbitrary. But I think the main difference is like, if I were to talk to a filmmaker who wanted to make a movie about ancient Egypt, the thing that I would try to emphasize is if you get this thing right, it will make your movie better. People will like it more. They will celebrate it. They will go back and rewatch it. They'll tell their friends to go see it because it will add this richness of depth that even people who know nothing about this subject will subconsciously pick up on, and it will just like enlighten their entire experience of the movie. It will flow into everything else that they do notice and just make it feel just much more real and tangible and interesting.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think the technicalities of city maybe don't matter quite as much as we as historians would like it to. But I think what you were saying earlier about like put some color on the walls is one of those historical accuracies that would really add depth to the feel of the movie as a whole and be more immersive.
Yeah, and feel like a new place.
I mean, now that you mention it, because I remember at least the piece that you wrote for the Journal of Near Eastern Archaeology. I remember you even had a section on the mangoes, and I think you had like a photo of it as well, which, you know, delighted me to no end. because that was in the section, I think.
You're not even the only person who gives me shit about the mangoes. Like, everyone is like, why is this guy talking so much about mangoes?
But, like, that's just it. Because I guess, like, I think it's been a hot minute since I read the piece. I have it on my computer somewhere, and we should probably link it in the show notes so other people can find it. But I remember your argument, you going kind of back and forth, like, it's such a small thing. And it bothers me because blah, blah, blah. And the argument that for like having them there was like the color palette. They wanted this orangey color to look good in the game.
And but mangoes didn't exist in ancient Egypt. And if you look at Egyptian tomb scenes and everything, the color palette is taken from everyday life. In that article, I have like a picture in the game and there's like a bunch of fruits and vegetables and things lying around in a market. And there's a basket of mangoes and they glow. I mean, they look like, it always reminds me of like in a Scooby-Doo cartoon when there's like the book that opens a secret passage and it's always a completely different color from the rest of the books. It looks like that. They just obviously look like the thing that doesn't belong in that scene. And it's because they're the one thing that didn't exist at the time. So, you know, in no Egyptian tomb scene is there a green to orange color gradient that appears anywhere. Whereas there are other, you know, combinations of colors that do occur in natural things that existed in Egypt at the time. And like, as an initial viewer, like let's say somebody who doesn't know much about ancient Egypt and is just seeing these things for the first time, probably doesn't stand out to them the way that it does to me, but it still feels like it doesn't belong. It just doesn't, the thing doesn't match the setting that it's in. Somehow, I used to listen to, what's his name? The guy who did all those like super obnoxious reviews of like Star Wars and Indiana Jones, like Mr. Plinkett or something. He's like, I don't know. There's these crazy like YouTube videos that are also super gross. He always says like, you didn't notice, but your brain did. And that's how I feel about the mangoes. It's like, okay, for someone who doesn't know anything about ancient Egypt, watching Exodus or, you know, seeing the mangoes in Assassin's Creed or whatever, there's no way you could ever articulate to anyone else what things weren't right about that scene. But on some level, something didn't quite match up. And you felt a sort of dissonance in what you were looking at. Even if you can't articulate it, it sort of bubbles up into your experience of the thing. It doesn't feel like everything that's there is supposed to be there. Like Christian Bale as Moses is a great example. I'm glad we can swear in this because when I first talked about this, I said, you know, is that Sigourney Weaver or whatever? But what I actually said was, is that Sigourney fucking Weaver? There's definitely a, is that Ben fucking Kingsley? Like every single time. It's just like, what is this person doing in this movie? Why is there this incredibly talented actor being made to look bad, honestly? Some of them I was like, man, if I were that actor with this illustrious career, I would want to bury this movie. Christian Bale especially. I mean, I'm sure there will be people who argue that his performance was excellent, but man, it was pretty clunky. A lot of his delivery of lines was just like, it's like, because this person is not supposed to be saying this thing at this time, right? And so even if you can't articulate what's wrong, you can feel these things don't fit together nicely in a way that produces a coherent whole. And that's my review of the whole movie. If I could sum it up in one line, a bunch of stuff that doesn't fit together nicely into a coherent whole.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not impressed by it. Definitely, I think I tend to focus too much on like the weird stuff that like only experts would probably care about. And I do recognize that. But I don't know, some things annoy me because again, yeah, it depends on like what clearly stands out, what is clearly wrong, what is clearly right. I don't know. Yeah, yeah.
There's really some value in a sort of like academic review of pop culture too. Like if we were writing a review of this movie from an academic perspective, the mismatch in the city would be a good thing to put in there. For me, it's, again, it's part of these perhaps somewhat arbitrary distinctions I make between creative license that works and creative license that doesn't. But yeah, there's a real value in taking these things that everyone has experienced and almost like reaction, you know, there's all these YouTube reaction videos where there's like some kind of informative content and then another expert kind of talks over it to give you more information. There's really a lot of value in taking these things that anyone can see at any time because it's streaming on Disney Plus, and then just talking about how it connects with the real things, because it's a great, you know, any knowledge must be acquired by somehow starting with what you know and adding one step at a time to that. And this is a very easy way to do it. So yeah, I think it's totally worthwhile to point out that the city is wrong, or, you know, that the population of Egypt couldn't have lost 400,000. I think it's like 400,000 families too, or something like this.
So it's a stupid number.
Yeah, it's like a ridiculous number of people. That would be like a massive like economic catastrophe if it happened now. If that number of people just got up and moved to another place, it would be like an incredible upheaval. In the ancient world, it would have been just like, it would leave a mark in the archaeological record, at least. That's quite certain.
So we're probably about ready to wrap up. Do either of you have any, like, we've done a lot of final thoughts already, but any like last impressions to leave with the audience?
We should probably say, would any of us be likely to recommend this to people?
I mean, it was fine. It wasn't particularly offensive or gory or unenjoyable. It just wasn't, I didn't have a bad time watching it. It just wasn't, it's not a movie that I would necessarily choose to watch in my downtime. I think if you're a fan of gritty pseudo-historical stuff, maybe, but it for me, it just wasn't that good of a movie. Which I think actually comes back to what Christian was saying about it hanging together as a coherent whole. It's not coherent, it's not cohesive, it just feels like little bits kind of stapled together.
This is just a bad gritty. Like, there's good gritty, right, that I'm like, it would be hard and other things. I mean, look, if I want to go gritty, I'd be like, Grave of the Fireflies, man. That will just kill your soul, but, like, in the best possible way, because it's an amazing, it's the best movie you'll never want to watch again, is how I say it. But, like, this is just plain bad, and the casting makes me angry and swear. Again, the fact that I can't see shit because it's so dark makes me angry, and then I swear at the TV. And then the creepy god boy makes me so angry I wanted to, like, throw my PS4 controller at the TV. But I didn't do that because I wanted a working TV. But, yeah. You know what? To me, this was like a too long, bad version of Prince of Egypt.
Yeah.
And I would 1000% be like, just go watch that.
Lexi, you perfectly summed it up. I don't think it's an awful movie. I didn't have a terrible time watching it or anything. I think I actually had kind of a nice time watching it. But the fact that the Prince of Egypt exists and is just so good. It's like, why would you waste time watching this movie when that movie is already telling the same story way, way, way better?
It's prettier, it's more fun, it's a more interesting story. I found the characters more compelling in Prince of Egypt than I do in Gods and Kings. Like,
yeah.
Just go watch the cartoon.
Yeah. Yeah, just go watch the better movie.
Yeah, this one I'm happy to consign to the heap of rubbish that we can just take out with yesterday's trash. You know, I don't know. I guess I'd be like, well, if you really want to see Sigourney, like, cosplaying in Egypt for some inexplicable reason, watch this. She has one line, or like three lines, and then wears a weird costume. Have fun.
I think the biggest question I'm left with after watching this movie is, who in the world is this movie for?
Yes, like, who's the audience? Who's your audience?
It's clearly not a naked cash grab. You know, I don't think it was meant to, you know, fleece money from American evangelicals who are super interested in biblical stories. I really don't think that's the case. I don't think a cynical explanation works, but then you're just kind of left with, like, why does this exist?
It can't be for the evangelicals because it's the influence of God is not directly obvious enough because of the naturalistic explanations. Like, that, they can't be the key audience, but it doesn't play to historical nerds like us because there's just too much to complain about, honestly. And it's, yeah, I don't know.
Hey, thanks for listening. Don't forget to leave us a review, and you can also follow us on social media at The Reading Party Podcast. If you'd like to leave us a book or movie suggestion, then email us at thereadingpartypod@gmail.com. See you next week.